With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, what's up? It's Thomas Nicholas, also known as Kevin from American Pie. And when I'm not going the growl, which I think is better known as the tongue tornado, I'm listening to the Total Reboot with Cam and Alexi.
Song in this movie, Don't Fear the Reaper.
Yeah,
I don't remember.
Na, 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 na. More freaking cowbell. I was listening to this pod late one night, and what should happen? I'm about to get a fright because this is the beginning of Total Reboot's Halloween miniseries. In honor of October, the spookiest month in the recorded records of human history, known for autumn in America, in Australia, not so much.
The beginnings of spring in the Southern Hemisphere.
What shall spring upon us but none other than a man known by two names. One, The Shape. Two, Michael Myers, baby. You are listening to Total Reboot, the only podcast that goes through the reboots, remakes, and ripoffs in cinema history. My name is Alexi Toliopoulos, and
my name is The Shape.
Oh my god, he's in here, and he can finally talk. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I actually love the name The Shape. I think it's a way cooler name than Michael Myers. I wish they never called him Michael Myers.
I think Mike Myers is one of the coolest cats that ever walked
this
planet.
Obviously, the name Mike Myers is cool. But Michael? Too formal.
Michael? Too Travolta, if you ask me. So yeah. Cameron, we're going to be talking about Halloween for the whole month. And of course, if you're not familiar with Halloween, a biographical story of a young man who would go on to become one of the world's most famous comedians before he started on Saturday Night Live. It is, of course, the rise of Mike Myers.
This is autobiographical?
Yeah, it's about a young man. It's his whole story leading up to creating a guy who's the most evil character in film history.
Well, I didn't know that. That's fucking wild. And by the way, this is not, we're not covering new ground by comparing Mike Myers to Michael Myers. In fact, many of our fans have made that leap for us many a time.
Definitely. We have, of course, before we started Total Reboot, we did another iconic podcast. Maybe actually is iconic at this point.
I think it is iconic. Yeah. It's official to say we're icons.
It's official to say that we are podcast legends.
Yeah.
We created Mike Check with Cameron James and Alexi Toliopoulos. We went through the entire filmography of Mike Myers just to check if it was still Shagadelic Baby.
We watched Austin Powers about 60 times for that show. We watched The
maybe
Love
nine,
Guru twice.
Nine more. I watched Love Guru 4 or 5 times, I think.
That's true. We watched all of them. And every few weeks, we would get a request from fans to cover the Halloween movies as part of Mike Check.
Yes.
Because, spookily, Mike Myers shares a name with the killer from the Halloween franchise.
Yes, yes, yes.
And we never did it.
We never did. We were like, not gonna do
not
it.
Not gonna do it.
Not gonna do it.
I don't freaking think so, okay?
Throw me a freaking bone over here. And by that bone, I mean do the Halloween franchise. And we're like, not groovy, baby.
Not groovy. No, Scotty, don't, I would say.
But now we are covering it.
Now we finally get to do it. I'll tell you what, I'm excited about doing the Halloween franchise because it's sort of, it's the most fucking crazy, all over the shop franchise in horror in many ways.
Yep.
It started again like 3 times. Mm-hmm. There are chapters that don't count as canon anymore. Yep. There's a random spin-off in the middle of this franchise.
For us as the reboot masters, I think this might be the most interesting franchise that we can cover. Because, like you said, it's fucked up.
It's
like,
ridiculous.
It's like there was no one at the helm, which there wasn't, to there kind of guide wasn't. What it should sound and feel like.
Yeah, there is. It's just been a moneymaker. That's what people have done with this. Like, the first movie is a classic, and then it has been spun off by the studio into just being a moneymaker every 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Up until kind of, I think, like, John Carpenter has sort of had a renaissance culturally within the last, like, 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
And now people want to return to the source.
Yes.
The original Halloween movie. And we are lucky enough to be living in a time where one of our favorite filmmakers, David Gordon Green,
DGG,
and one of our favorite writers, Danny McBride, are rebooting Halloween. It comes out in like 2 weeks or something like that.
Yeah, or it comes out at the end of the month. So we should tell you guys what the shape of this month will look like for us. Obviously, today we're starting off with the classic, the icon of cinema, John Carpenter's Halloween from 1978.
So good. Two icons talking about an icon. That's exactly what's happening today.
That's what's happening today. You're hearing it live from New York, Saturday night style, baby. And then the second episode that we will be covering will be about the first kind of reboot or retooling of what this franchise wanted to be.
Yeah.
John Carpenter, of course, wanted to make Halloween an anthology series.
Twilight Zone style.
Live from the Twilight Zone.
It's spooky times, baby.
And so this we're going to be covering in episode 2, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which is not connected to Michael Myers in any way.
Then the franchise tried to reboot itself with Halloween H2O.
Halloween.
I'm saying it Henry Higgins style. I'm hoping that I get to My Fair Lady you at some point.
I hope so. I want to be freaking... I want you to freaking Eliza Doolittle to me, baby.
You want to be Doolittle? I'll be doing a little more than doing that.
Okay. So we're talking about H2O. So after Halloween Season of the Witch, they're like, actually, let's just go back to The Return of Michael Myers.
Yeah.
We had a couple of movies after that as well. Yeah.
Shit. Who cares?
A whole lot of who gives a stink. Yeah. Who knows?
Straight up to Halloween H2O,
yep.
Which was a sort of franchise reboot, bringing back the classic Jamie Lee Curtis.
As Laurie Strode. And she strode right back in and collected that paycheck to make that movie. She's been very honest about that in the last few years.
And then there was the first, I guess, official auteur reboot.
This is episode 4 for us.
The entire franchise was taken over by everyone's favorite shock rocker.
Did you say shock rocker? Do you mean Adriano Zumbo?
Adriano Zombie? No, Rob Zombie.
Oh, of the American Zombo family.
Yeah. He made two. He made Halloween and Halloween 2, which are basically direct reboots of both of them.
I believe Halloween 1 that he made is a direct remake, and then Halloween 2 is just not his own thing.
Oh, yeah, just straight appearing into the zombie mind.
Yeah, I can't wait to dive into fucking Rob Zombie. I've refused my entire life to see a movie directed by a guy called Rob Zombie. And now we have to do it for work.
Yeah, you know, his official name is actually Robert Zombie. And then we will close out this chapter with the David Gordon Green, Danny McBride Halloween reboot slash sequel slash lega sequel.
Yeah, it seems like a lega sequel. It's interesting because what they're saying, Cameron, what we have heard is that what it does is it takes everything out of canon except for Halloween 1.
Yeah.
This is a Lego sequel to the original Halloween film.
It's a direct sequel. That means everything from 2 onwards didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of those things that is both exciting and incredibly annoying yep. at the same time. One of those things that you go, okay, that's cool that they're like harking back to the original, but also I've freaking seen Laurie Strode in a bunch of other movies yeah. and she's got Josh Hartnett's her son.
What happened to Hartnett?
Where's Hartnett? How come he's not in it anymore? I guess he never existed. Was that a freaking fever dream on my behalf? Well, we'll find out.
Cameron, do you think it's time for us to just dive straight into The Chilling Waters of Halloween by John Carpenter?
Let's do it.
I watched him for 15 years, sitting in a room looking at this night, inhumanly patient, waiting for some secret, silent alarm. Michael?
He's on his way. You've got to believe me, officer. He is coming to Haddonfield.
I saw the boogeyman.
Well, I'm here tonight. I'm not about to let anything happen to you.
What's the boogeyman?
As a matter of fact, it was.
Halloween, 1978, directed by John Carpenter. The night he came home. If this was about Mike Myers, the tagline would just be, "The night he came."
Very psychedelic, baby.
In John Carpenter's horror classic, a psychotic murderer, institutionalized since childhood for the murder of his sister, escapes and stalks a bookish teenage girl and her friends while his doctor chases him through the streets.
Bookish.
Bookish.
What an odd little descriptive word there.
I mean, there's a couple of scenes where she's holding books.
Yeah, she loves to hold books. She reads a couple of them. Yeah. She likes to knit as well. I believe knitting would be... If
this
someone's knitting, you're
bookish,
like...
bookish, nitty, little...
little rascal of a
little
woman.
Little freak, little nebbish. Mm. She's nebbish. She's Woody Allen type.
Yeah, she's a Woody Allen type. She's nebbish. She's a freaking virgin.
Yeah, she's a verge. It's my favorite style of holding books is teenager style.
Yeah, to the chest.
You have like 6 of them and they're all to your chest yeah. and you're walking and home from school.
And you've got an empty backpack yeah, on your back. Yeah, an empty backpack. Clearly empty backpack.
Yes, okay, so this is the original. I hadn't seen it until probably like 2 years ago.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, never seen the shit. So recently, within the last 2 years.
Within the last decade, you've seen it.
Yeah.
I think I was pretty late to this as well. I think I saw this when I would have been about 20, 21. So within the last couple of years as well.
Yeah. Within the last couple of years.
Like,
recently.
Last 6 months or so.
Yeah,
or
like
something.
Recently. Yeah.
But I was drawn to it when I started becoming interested in horror. And when you become interested in horror, this is obviously one of the ones that's on every list. And John Carpenter is known as one of the great horror film directors, one of the great genre directors. In the past, on our old podcast, Blank Slate Movie Podcast, we've talked about Escape from New York, I believe, and Big Trouble in Little China. Mm-hmm. And so I've been very excited to get back together with you and talk about John Carpenter films. Because I think we had great conversations about him. People have always been asking us to do more of his work.
Well, yeah, it's
people
like...
People are always harassing us.
We're getting harassed a lot lately, guys. If you could really tone that down, that would be great because it's bad for our mental health.
We're freaking out over here.
I'm freaked. He's deep.
In Total Reboot HQ, we're fucking going meltdown mode.
Yeah, it's absolutely freaking meltdown mode. I'm going to go full Britney Spears 2008 or whatever it was.
Seven.
Shave my goddamn head off.
I think it's cool.
So I got to be honest with our listeners. I hadn't seen a single John Carpenter film until you forced me to watch them for our old podcast.
I popped your eyes open, Kubrick style, baby.
Awoke something in me.
Yeah, you're a big Carpenter fanboy
now. I have become a Carpenter fanboy. And you know, it's going to sound so lame to say it, but I think what I like about him and what I like about this movie in particular is that it's cool.
He's a very, very cool director.
It's just cool, right? That's the only way I can describe it. He's like, even the things that have dated, like some of the acting styles, or you look back at Halloween, you go, okay, some of it's a bit hammy.
Yeah.
You can see that it's a low budget movie at times, but what is it about it that's just freaking cool?
I think he creates this atmosphere that is entirely unique to his films.
Mm.
And I find that people in history have become, or people in film industry and in people, filmmakers that have followed him have become very attracted to that, because I think he's someone very interesting for us to touch on in our first kind of big lump of episodes, because he, I think, is officially the most remade filmmaker in film history.
Really?
Assault on Precinct 13's been remade.
The Thing
has a Lego sequel or whatever, or prequel or whatever you want to call it.
Halloween, obviously.
You didn't even need to bring it up, obviously.
No, I didn't. What's another one? Straw Dogs?
That's not him. That's
Peckinpah. Yeah.
There's, well, of course, we got The Rock wanting to make a sequel to Big Trouble in Little China.
To see The Rock getting up and amongst that shit.
Oh, love to see The Rock take on The Jock, which is what I call Kurt Russell. The Fog has also been remade. Just so many. There's probably some that I'm even forgetting right now, but most of his movies at this point have been remade.
That's awesome. That's a sign of a good filmmaker. People want to copy your shit.
People just absolutely want to copy your
people
shit.
People like, I just, not up. Only do I want to take on the vibe of this guy, I just want to make that movie. So when you first saw Halloween, you know, very recently when you were 21.
Yeah, in the last few months.
Yeah.
I think I saw it for the first time today, actually.
Were you able to enjoy it as a film, like a study of a film?
Mm.
Or was it more like a curiosity because you've seen all these tropes aped so many times, ripped off so many times? Like, how was your first experience of this movie?
I think my first experience was kind of a balancing act of the two. Because you are seeing cinema history unfold in front of your eyes. Mm-hmm. But also, you can't... With the works of John Carpenter, I feel like it's hard not to just get swept up into them and just be able to place yourself back in that time and experience the scares for real. Because he has such a unique atmosphere, and I think it is often created by his beautiful soundtracks that he constructs for most of his films by himself. No help, no input. But I think for something like this, where, like you were saying before, you can tell it's a low-budget movie, it's so visceral, and it's so well-made for something so with such a low budget. And because of that low budget, there's kind of like a grittiness to it as well.
Yeah.
There's a griminess to it and a more handmade quality to it that I think those films from the 70s that have that ability, that have that production value, it adds to their scariness. I'm thinking of something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre as well, where if you watch that today, that movie still is terrifying. There's a reality to it.
Yeah.
Even beyond the hamminess.
But I'll say, like, you know, I watched it a couple of years ago, loved it. And then when I rewatched it this morning for this podcast, in my memory, it looked lower budget than it actually is. But I'm watching it today, it's really quite slick. It looks gorgeous. Yeah. Like, whoever shot this movie with him, it's like the suburbs are boring to look at, but to make the suburbs look cinematic and interesting is really cool, especially when over half of this movie is shot at night. So the lighting of it, where you're mainly big chunks of the movie, you're not even seeing people's faces. You're just seeing them in silhouette. They're lit from behind. It looks fucking great.
It looks beautiful, and the lighting is so natural.
The lighting is awesome.
It's just so natural. I think that's what makes it even scarier, is that there's no, like, there's no highlighting. There's not too much cinematic lighting. There's just enough to kind of reveal people's faces a little bit. But it's just like, even when they're in their houses, there's no real lights on in the homes. It just feels like either moonlight's coming in or something like that, but it never feels natural. It never feels stylized.
Yeah.
And it kind of adds that sense of reality. And I think the best lighting moment in this film is when Laurie goes upstairs to the house where all her friends have been murdered.
Yeah, that's the sequence I'm thinking of, yeah.
And we just see her, like, up against a door, and there's just a dark, complete darkness behind her, and the light is raised just that tiny bit enough to reveal that Michael has been there the entire time. And that is, I think, genuinely chilling still to this day.
Yeah, there's some great little jump scares in it. Hey, you know a fair bit about the slasher genre. How early in the piece was this one as far as, like, inventing what the slasher is?
I would say that if we had to put a definitive stamp on it, I think you can say that Halloween is the first official slasher. This is the one that kicked off the movement, kicked off all the copycats, all the things inspired by it. Mm-hmm. There were several films that before this that would be called like the proto-slashers.
Yeah.
Like Psycho is the original proto-slasher.
Sure.
Where it follows some of the tropes, it created a lot of the tropes, and I think Halloween, obviously it owes a lot to Psycho.
It's got Janet Leigh's goddamn freaking daughter in it.
Exactly. And Donald Pleasance's character is also called Sam Loomis.
Sam Loomis, which I knew he was called Dr. Loomis, but it wasn't until this viewing that I realized he was called Dr. Sam Loomis.
Yeah, which is the character of Janet Leigh's lover in Psycho.
Just change his first name, John.
Call him Billy Loomis. Hang on a second. Hang on a second. That's the guy from Screamos.
Hang on a trick or treat. That's goddamn, what's his name? Poor man's Johnny Depp. I can't remember his name.
Skeet Ulrich.
Skeet. By the way, you know Skeet means to...
Yeah.
Yeah, dude.
I've skated.
Yeah, me too.
I'm a Tony Hawk's pro skater too, okay?
Do you reckon he should change his name to Squirt Ulrich?
It'd be more modern.
Yeah, it would be more modern.
I think he should change his name to Cumball or... So, of course, Psycho is the first proto-slasher. And around that time as well, there was a movie that we did talk about slightly at the time by Michael Powell called Peeping Tom, which is another serial killer movie. So, I think those two films coming out at the exact same point in history, that 1960, they are breaking all these boundaries. They're taking the Hays Code apart. Mm-hmm. They're featuring serial killers in really... terrifying and almost realistic at the point in time, really realistic and nuanced ways. So in both of those films, they feature several things that I think would come on to define the slasher, including getting slashed up, but also being able to see the world at points in time from the view, literally the point of view of the killer.
Yeah, so that had been done before Halloween, the POV killer shot.
POV killer shot.
Because that's one of the most iconic tropes of this movie that was then ripped off shamelessly by Friday the 13th and many other slashes that came out afterwards. I think, you know, if you're making a low-budget movie, I mean, it's the thing that we all know about Jaws, is that they couldn't show the shark, so they just decided to make the camera the shark.
Yeah, for a big go chunk from of time. The POV.
And this is like maybe the first one that I'm aware of to work within those boundaries as well. It's one of the great openers for any horror movie. Even though it's goofy, like it's a little kid. Like
it's a little kid.
It's so stupid.
You see him putting on a mask. He goes up. He kills his sister. You see her boobies.
His sister's tits. It's like goofy as fuck. The acting from the sister and her boyfriend is so cheesy.
It's hammy. Especially for everything else in the movie is either quite realistic or nuanced in a way or naturalistic.
It's the last thing they shot too.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Because the house, the Myers house was actually a dilapidated house in the neighborhood.
Yeah, and they cleaned it all up.
That's just how they shot it. They shot it as it was for the movie. Mm. And then at the end, they cleaned it up, painted it, and shot that.
Yeah.
Final thing, they didn't have much money left, so it was all shot in that kind of Steadicam, Panaglide camera. And it's crazy that that's the last thing they shot and they got those two shitty actors to...
Yeah. Well, they got all the good ones to be in the actual movie.
Yeah.
I think the only other film that I would say existed before Halloween that is the most similar to it is this movie that I think we might have talked about on the old podcast years ago with Craig Anderson. It's a movie called Black Christmas from 1974. It's directed by Bob Clark, who is, of course, best known for making Christmas movies, A Christmas Story as well.
Oh, really?
Probably two of the biggest iconic Christmas films of all time, Black Christmas and Christmas Story. Black Christmas is not exactly a slasher film because it's not people getting slashed up, but it is set in a sorority house. There is a killer on the loose killing the sorority women. It's set around a holiday, and it's got a killer called Billy, who we never see Billy. You never ever see Billy at all. Like, not even hints of him, really.
It's not POV style?
We see POV of him killing the women, and that's probably the closest. And we see POV of Billy watching them. Mm-hmm. And Billy has a crazy voice. He's like, hey, Billy, I'm going to kill you. And just like makes prank calls and stuff to all the women to terrify them. And it's the original movie where the call comes from inside the house.
Is that where that line comes from?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so many things that I thought were from Halloween, but clearly just aren't. Like that one.
Yeah, and...
Have you checked the children? I always thought that was from Halloween.
Yeah.
That's not. That's from some other bullshit.
That's from something else. I can't even tell you what it is, but I think originally, I can't remember if this is true. So, Bob Clark and John Carpenter worked together a few years later, or they met a few years later after Black Christmas. And John Carpenter asked him if he would ever do a sequel. He said, no, I'm done with horror. I want to make cool kids movies and stuff now. And he asked him, "What if you were to make a sequel to it, what would it be?" And apparently he told him that he would have been caught. Billy would have been caught. He would be in an institution. Then he would escape the institution and it would be on Halloween.
Oh, so John Carpenter ripped that idea off?
Well, he said, the truth is John didn't copy Black Christmas. He wrote a script, directed the script, he did the casting. Halloween is his horror movie, and besides, the script came to him already titled anyway. He liked Black Christmas and may have been influenced by it, but in no way did John Carpenter copy the idea. 15 other people at the time had thought to do a movie called Halloween, but the script came to John with that title.
I actually heard the original title was The Babysitter Murders.
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well. It was The Babysitter Murders, and then it evolved into wanting to do Halloween.
Because they could tie it to a time of year.
Time of year. And also, isn't it crazy that they could just have the title Halloween? Like, film had existed for like 80-something years at that point.
Yeah, and no one had called anything Halloween at that point. It's insane.
It's insane, right? Like, you think like one of the first movies should be, oh, yes, let's make a movie about All Hallows Eve.
Yeah. But also, The Babysitter Murders makes more sense as a title. It feels like when you watch the movie now, it feels like the Halloween element is tacked on to this movie.
Yeah.
There's fuck all trick-or-treating going on in this movie. Yeah. There's not... Like, the idea of a man walking around a neighborhood in a mask makes sense during Halloween.
Yeah, during Halloween.
But not being noticed by people. But you don't see any of that shit in this movie. It is literally three separate babysitters get stalked and killed by this guy. And it just happens to be on Halloween. Like, why? What are the parents doing on Halloween in Haddonfield? Where are they at?
I would love that sequel.
That's
see
the
parents
I want
to
see.
Just going to like the school hall and all fucking.
I reckon it's
something.
The Ice Storm. It's that movie,
oh,
The Ice
Storm. My God, if Ang Lee did this movie as a sequel to this, where it's just like Kevin Kline and Sigourney Weaver going down at each other.
Yeah. And then cut to the kids all being killed by Mike Myers.
Yeah.
That's the shit I want to see.
That's groovy, dude.
Should we make a horror movie about swingers?
Oh, yeah, and we've got Vince Vaughn jerking off, looking through a little peephole. I was like, that's money, baby, that's money.
That's it. Would be, we would have as subtle morals as this movie does when it comes to sex.
It's interesting because the morality of this movie gets spoken about a lot in like film criticism and film history, where they're saying it's like a grubby movie where it's like...
Sluts get punished.
Sluts get punished, but I don't know. I don't see that.
Well, obviously, you can't watch it and not see that. They all claim that it was an accident.
Yeah.
John Carpenter says stuff like, no, we just wanted like to show that these other people were busy. They just like weren't paying attention to the kids.
Yeah.
And what else do teenagers do apart from like they're with their boyfriends and they're mucking around? Yeah. Like, that's so it was just an excuse to have them be distracted so Michael could get into the house.
I think it's something that's so entwined with horror is that idea that there has to be a transgression for someone to get their comeuppance.
But do you think that was always in horror, or is that stuff that has come out since Pauline Kael would write about this shit in the 70s? Like, after Halloween, I'm sure Pauline Kael was one of the early critics who would say, and all the people that sinned, who committed a cardinal sin, they all died. But Laurie Strode, the pure virgin, she survives. Do you reckon after that, that's when horror makers went, oh yeah, we should do that?
I think it's a kind of, it's a chicken and the egg thing. Because I think transgression always exists in horror. Like it was always about, you know, you look at Frankenstein and that's someone who is...
True. Playing God.
Playing God. He's going against God and then he will get his comeuppance at the end.
Yeah,
whatever.
I
don't even remember.
I've only seen Young Frankenstein. Yeah. I've got to be honest. And that ends with a dance sequence, I think.
I think the original's pretty similar. but you know, that transgression has always been part of horror. And I think for something like this, maybe it's people trying to find what the...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Transgression is, like, why these people fall victim to the monster.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's just like, I mean, like that sexy nurse at the start of the movie. Mm. Which I don't even know. I'm thinking of Halloween 2 maybe.
Halloween 2 is the one with the nurse,
sexy nurse.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about the woman that drives Donald Pleasance to the institution. And then you see Michael jump on top of the car.
Yeah.
That, like, to me, there's no reason for him to be stalking them. They haven't transgressed anything.
Yeah, well, he doesn't kill her.
Yeah, exactly.
But he
terrorizes them.
He's never seen her fuck, so he can't kill her.
Yeah.
He can only kill people he's seen fuck or naked. Which is awesome.
But I think there's people that they relate to the killer for some reason in this film.
In this movie. Well, and it's just like, I reckon it's that thing of like, it does tap into stuff that we would now call MRA culture, where you're watching and you're like, yes, she was being unvirtuous or whatever.
Yeah.
She was having sex when she should have been looking after these children. So, yeah, I'm watching her get punished. Also, I'm not fucking right now. I'm watching a fucking movie.
I'm here with my fucking kids watching this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And someone's fucking my wife. Someone should come kill my wife.
But I love it. This movie, I gotta be, it titillated me.
It's beautiful, right?
It made me horny a little bit.
Really?
Yeah.
Did this movie make you horny, baby?
Officially, this Mike Myers movie made me horny, baby.
Well, it ticks the boxes. It's funny, it's sexy, it's cool.
Yeah, there we go. It's officially, we've checked it, and it's groovy.
It's still shagadelic,
it's
baby.
It's still shagadelic. We did it. It's because it's like, there's sex every like 10 minutes in this movie almost. It's just like, the teens are talking about it all the time.
Yeah.
Probably even sooner than every 10 minutes. And the murder, yeah, like tying sex and murder is not new, but like...
But it is groovy.
It is cool. I don't know. I mean, I don't really care too much about the whole like final girl has to be virtuous thing. I think that's like a lame...
Yeah.
I like seeing that get turned on its head. Obviously, yeah. I'm of the Scream generation.
Exactly. Where you like to see your horror be subverted. But this is this is the original. And I think even though we've seen it be subverted so many times, we've seen it play out so many times, because this film is so perfect. Like it is, I would say this is as close as you get to a masterpiece slasher.
Mm.
As far as, like, I think this is one of the best movies, one of the best horror films of all time. And each time I revisit it, I love it even more. I fall more deeply in love with this movie until you don't want to look at the hole in the disc anymore. On my Blu-ray. But I think what it does is, like, it has the perfect final girl. It has the perfect villain.
Yeah, that's true. Let's talk about these two then. We haven't really talked too deeply about them. Let's talk about Jamie Lee Curtis. This is her feature film debut.
Introducing Jamie Lee Curtis.
Isn't that crazy?
It's crazy because she's so young. She's like 18 years old in this film. but such a mature performer.
Yeah. Oh, she holds her own incredibly. She doesn't... She's 18.
Yeah, 18 or 19, I think.
She doesn't even seem like she's a teenager.
Yeah.
Like, there's something about her voice, her presence... That's like, I'm watching someone who's like a mature, like a someone who's in her late 20s.
Student.
Yeah. Yeah. She's like an adult. She's lived a life. I guess she had lived a life. Her mum was a Hollywood star. And
so was her dad, Tony Lee Curtis.
Tony Curtis. Curtis. That's her dad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Tony Curtis. From
Some Like It Hot.
And Some Like It Very Hot. The guy's a very fuckable man.
Yeah, he is.
I love Tony Curtis as an actor. As a guy, I don't know.
I don't know anything about
him. I don't know. All I remember about him is whether he shat on, like, Brokeback Mountain when it was coming out.
Oh, really?
I was just like, oh, he's very old school then. He's very old school. Yeah, sure. And Janet Leigh, of course, is the...
Marion Crane
from Psycho. Mm-hmm. So, I think it is very appropriate casting getting Jamie Lee Curtis.
You could almost say it's stunt casting.
It's stunty, baby. It's very stunty. And she's just superb in this film.
She's great. She's just awesome. She's like, it's the perfect blend of like strong and vulnerable at the same time. Like whenever you see this term bandied about strong leading woman or strong female role, it's often to the detriment of a good movie. Mm. It's often like just someone who's never shaken, never scared. They like know how to fight well. Like Trinity from The Matrix, who's like, she's a great actor, Carrie Ann Moss. Yeah. But I don't give a fuck about watching Trinity fight because I think like, yeah, she's just going to kick everyone's ass.
Yeah. She's unstoppable.
She's unstoppable. But
almost like what Ripley became in
What Sarah Connor became. Mm. I kind of like that this character, Laurie Strode, she is strong, which she has to be. But she also screams a lot. Mm. She fucking falls downstairs. She gets stabbed a few times. She's like traumatized. She's crying. The movie ends with her crying.
She's not an expert.
Yeah.
You never see her being an expert. You just know that she's smart because she's like well-spoken, talks to these kids, has respect for the kids that she's with.
She's bookish.
She knows how to knit. She can crochet probably. but you see her as like this, as this kind of soft, quiet, nerdy girl who's a little bit scared, a little bit intimidated by the raucousness of her friends. She's the good girl.
Yeah.
And it just, all of it feels, I think we're coming back to this term a lot, but naturalistic in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think her performance, like you said, it carries that idea of being scared, but also knowing that you have to live through it
and just having to
go through it and caring. I think that's what makes her such a unique character in horror. Is that she truly does care. She has that softness about her, but through the softness, there is a tenacity to keep going.
Yes. It's like, it's survival. Instinct kicks in.
Yeah.
And there's something very cool about watching someone not freeze in horror, but know they have to act and they just do it.
Yeah.
And they don't even know what their next move is. She's running around the neighborhood. No one lets her into their home, which, by the way, fuck, who are those people?
Well, they're all out at the swingers party.
She knocks on one door and she's screaming. She's like, please let me in, let me in. And the lights turn on and you see someone peer at her through the window and then they turn the lights off. Who are these assholes in Haddonfield?
Well, the suburbs suck, man.
The burbs suck. The city rules.
Exactly. Got to be an urbanite.
And I grew up in the burbs.
Mm.
And, you know, I did a lot of knock and run.
Really? Yeah. That's why you probably got this poor girl killed.
Yeah, I'm the boy who cried wolf. I was running around knocking on doors, causing a ruckus, and then as a result, Laurie Strode got terrorized for a night. So yeah, it's my fault.
And so Michael Myers, the famous shagadelic villain of this film.
The groovy shape himself.
Yeah, the groovy shape. I love that.
Yeah. If he was a shape, it would be the male symbol.
Mm, and it would be dangling over a hairy chest.
Yes. He's great, obviously. It's like there's nothing to him. He's nothing in this movie.
I think,
and I love that. I hate mythology surrounding these villains.
Mm.
I hate the mythology that eventually surrounds Michael Myers in the later movies. I hate Jason. yeah. from Friday the 13th.
I hate Jason.
I hate him. He sucks.
Yeah, I relate to him. He's got mummy issues. Too much mummy issues. I can relate to the character too much.
The first Friday the 13th is cool. I like that it's just his mum. It's Mrs. Voorhees doing the killing. And that in the original Friday the 13th, Jason is just a kid who died.
Exactly.
I love that. That's cool.
Yeah.
It subverts what you think it's going to be. But then I hate that. Freddy, yeah, sure.
Freddy rules.
He's cool. He's cool. We kind of like Freddy.
I love Freddy.
But any...
Freddy's one of my comedy idols.
You love... He's your favorite comedian.
He's my favorite comedian.
Freddy and the genie from Aladdin. But I love that there's nothing to Michael. All we know about him is that when he was a kid, he had a psychotic snap and killed two people.
Yeah.
He was institutionalized. Dr. Sam Loomis describes him as pure evil.
Yeah.
That's all we get.
That's all it is. And it's just like, and then you've just got this Van Helsing type character of Dr. Sam Loomis just trying to take him down. It's his life mission.
It's so good that there's psychologists out there who are like, if my patient escapes, it's my duty to kill them.
I will chase him down. And I just love like where, the way that things are kind of thrown away in this film as well. It's like, where did he go? He drove off. Where did he learn how to drive? And stuff like that. Maybe people were teaching him how to drive in the institution.
It's just explained. Yeah. Like in one quick line. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe somebody, he says it in an accusatory way. He's like, well, maybe somebody taught him how to drive.
I reckon it was him.
The fucking, Dr. Loomis did.
Yeah. Yeah, he's trying to reach out to him. He's like, well, if I sit him on my lap and teach him how to pull the gear stick.
It's funny that, like, he was his doctor for 20 years or however long it was, and he's so willing to shoot him in the head. It's just like...
He's got this revolver that he's carrying around.
Why does he even have that? He's a fucking medical professional.
And a giant silver revolver.
And all it takes is, like, Michael's escaped, and he's not, like, my patient who I've worked with for 2 decades and who I've been trying to, like... get to the core of.
I've been trying to get this cunt to talk.
It's not even, I can talk him down. Yeah. I can like, I can get him back to safety. It's, I have to kill him.
Not even bring him back. I don't have to capture him. I need to shoot him in the head 6 or 8 times.
Do you reckon that's every psychiatrist? Like, we don't know that about psychiatry, but when you do the degree, they also teach you how to shoot a gun and like, it will be your responsibility.
Yeah. At the end of the Hippocratic Oath, there's just like, if the patient escapes, here's a fucking nickel revolver that you have to go and shoot them in the head with. Yeah.
God, that's so good. Oh, man. And like, Loomis rules in this movie. He's the hero of it in a way.
So,
you know?
I love this performance by Donald Pleasance as well because he is so manic and just sweaty and running around and stuff. And just like, he's like this chubby middle-aged man with no hair.
I think he's having a ball. Like, it seems like he's really enjoying doing it because it is essentially like a cop character. Mm. It's like a cop or a detective. He's like you said, he's Van Helsing.
He's Van Helsing, man.
It's like, it would have been fun maybe for him. I mean, he must have liked that he did 4 more Halloween movies.
Yeah,
he worked with Carpenter in Escape from New York. He's the president in Escape from New York.
He is the president of Escape from New York. Yeah. I listened to, when I watched this movie again for the podcast, I watched it with the commentary track that was recorded probably like 5 or 6 years ago with Jamie Lee Curtis and John Carpenter talking about it. They're old friends, of course. They became like best friends from working on this movie.
Two icons talking about an icon.
So talking about an icon, not unlike us right now. Yeah. And then it was very entertaining. It's one of my favorite commentaries I've listened to recently because they're also catching up over Lost Times. They're talking about the movie. Jamie Lee Curtis hates horror movies. She's like, God, John, that's so scary. That's so scary. They talked about Donald Pleasance and what a fun guy he was to work with. But they were also saying that he didn't give a shit about this movie until it started making money. And then he's just like, I love it now. I love it.
I could buy that.
And just attached himself back into the franchise.
Yeah. I could see that he's sort of like, he's treating it almost like a bit of a joke. There's some really wild choices in it. Like there are moments in the middle of this movie where he just has fun. His character has fun. Like he scares those kids.
Yeah.
You know that bit where the kids like approach the Myers house and he's hiding behind the bushes watching them and he does a voice and he goes like, get away from the house or something. And they like run off screaming and he chuckles to himself.
He's saving their lives.
Yeah,
but
he's also having fun while he's doing it.
I think it's just like, he's a real guy. That's what a real guy would be like in this situation. Like, well, that was fun. Now back onto the hell that I'm in of trying to kill this 21-year-old maniac that's coming around to stab all the babysitters in town.
Why do you think Mike Myers wanted to kill his sister and her boyfriend?
Mike Myers. Mike Myers did it. Well, probably horny.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think if this was Mike Myers, not Michael Myers, in that opening scene, I reckon it would have ended a little differently.
He would have killed his dad.
Yeah.
There have been a lot of daddy issues tied up with that guy.
Yeah, why do you think it's like sex that triggers this whole thing? Because it is, it's like all throughout the movie. You can't even ignore it. It's,
yeah,
it's the central theme of the movie, is that sex makes this guy want to kill.
Well, I don't know. Sex makes me want to spill. That's all I could say. I think, I don't know. He's just like this 11-year-old psycho kid. Like,
he's six.
Yeah. Oh, six. Sorry. For some reason, I think he's 11.
No, 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 dude.
I guess that's where my stuff started happening.
Yeah, it's very odd, like, that a six-year-old would even know what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's cool.
Good on him.
Yeah.
Someone had to do it.
Yeah, that's true.
Someone had to tell people sex is bad. I think one thing that I really noticed this time when rewatching the movie, speaking of that little six-year-old boy staring at people and you're seeing it through his eyes, is that while we do see a lot of the movie through the POV of Michael, we see the movie through lots of people's points of perspective. We'll see it through Laurie's eyes, her POV shots at some point, when we see her spotting Michael for the first few times. But I think what I noticed this time that made this movie so effective as a whole piece is that most of the photography in this film is also long sustained shots that are shot with a Steadicam. It gives it a feeling that we are always in the presence of the predator in this film. That's something that I really got stuck into this time. I'm just like, wow, this is so either intentionally clever or just by chance clever that the entire film, whether it's seen from someone's direct point of view or we're just seeing the natural coverage of the film, it does feel similar. It does feel the same. It gives that lurking presence of someone watching them at all times.
Well, I guess that's the, that's the design of those kind of shots when they don't cut is to make you feel like, am I supposed to be watching this?
Yeah.
Because it goes for so long. There's a couple where the kids are just walking along the street after school and it's a long shot that goes for like 40 seconds. And at like 20 seconds into that shot, you're like, why is there no movement? And then it's because you're the silent person who's staring at these schoolgirls.
Yeah. And I'm like, hang on a second, I'm getting deja vu right now.
One of my favorite shots is also quite early in the movie when it's a long shot of Laurie as she's walking away from the camera and then the shape steps into the side of the frame watching her. And it holds for like 20 seconds.
Yeah.
And it just watches her get further away while he doesn't move. And all you hear is his breathing on the soundtrack. It's so good.
Yeah.
I also love that it's just daytime.
Yeah. I think this movie, what makes it as well so special and so effective when we get into night is that the daytime stuff, when we're being introduced to Laurie and her friends and the kids that she's looking after, it is so slow. We're just getting time to spend time with these characters. We're seeing Michael driving around.
That's
watching
another one of my favorite things, is that he drives a car in this movie.
He just got a beat up station wagon that he's driving
around. Speeds around in a car.
Yeah. With his little mask on.
Yeah, in the middle of the day. I love it.
And we're just seeing them get, like, we're just getting to know them as just naturalistic. They're just walking around. They're like, oh, I'll see you after school. Oh, I've got a babysit and stuff like that. And it just feels so real. And then we get into the hyper scary stuff at nighttime. We see a change in day where we see, like, it's set in autumn. Obviously, it's Halloween.
Yep.
But because it's filmed in Los Angeles, they don't really have autumn there. It's just summer and gets a bit colder, and then we, you know, it's meant to look like a Illinois, Chicago and type area where suburbs, it's meant to be like Home Alone. I mean, I don't think that was a reference for them, but you know what I mean.
No, they love John Hughes.
It's meant to be a John Hughes-esque film. But, you know, we don't see any autumn leaves because they don't exist in LA. And then we see her come out of her house in the evening after she's gone home and gotten changed after school. Then we start seeing the dead leaves just start flying around. And while that is something that they had to do for necessity to make them there, it does signify like a change in the film where things start to go dark.
Yes. I'll tell you one thing I love about the use of location in this movie. And again, I don't know. Like I said, I don't know too much about the origins of the slasher, but I feel like whether it was by necessity of budget or just it was a deliberate choice in the writing of this movie, setting it in the suburbs seems like this is one of the earliest movies to make normalcy and mediocrity a setting for terror.
Mm.
And I think that is so cool. And we've seen it everywhere since, obviously. But it's like such a shift away from gothic horror.
Yeah.
Or even like paranormal horror. It's like, okay, this happens in your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. There's just clotheslines.
Yes, all the terror comes to you.
All iconography of the burbs. Clotheslines, station wagons, driveways.
Kids playing catch.
Yeah, fluoro lights, all that kind of
shit.
Kids
playing hockey on the street. Game on, game off. Mike Myers is hanging out.
All that shit is now... is now just where horror happens. And that is, we've seen it a lot since, but it feels like this movie must have been, if not the first, one of the first, to bring horror to America.
That's such a good point.
And that's probably why it was such a hit.
Because,
fucking horror movies, everyone always loves horror movies, but if you're a teenager and you hear about a movie that's... about a killer who comes to your neighborhood. Mm. You're like, I'll go watch that fucking movie.
Yeah, I think it is really the first like that, because Psycho is like, she goes to the killer.
Mm-hmm.
Peeping Tom, the killer is the main character. It's set in London.
Mm.
Then with, I guess, Black Christmas is closer, but it's not there either because it's at a university.
Yeah.
It's at a sorority house and the killer gets into the house.
Yeah.
Whereas this it's the whole neighborhood is in danger.
Mm.
And I think that's such a good point. I think that's why people connected with it. So I think in horror genre, that wasn't really happening. Maybe more I'm thinking of classic genres. It's more in line with kind of sci-fi, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Okay, yeah,
and the remake that came out around the same time as this movie. While it's not suburban, it is still a terror coming into their home. But this is totally different.
And maybe that's something that we need to keep in mind for watching these reboots, is seeing how they tried or how they succeeded or failed.
Yeah.
With like extending that premise or bringing horror to other elements of Americana or suburbia or the city or anything like that. I think from what we've seen of the trailer of the new David Gordon Green Halloween, it looks like it's going to be very much in line with this one.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other ones, like one's set at a school and I don't know. Season of the Witch is something entirely different.
I don't even know what Season of the Witch is.
No.
And that's what we're going to be talking about next week. But I think before we close up, maybe we can talk about the film briefly that happened in between the original Halloween and Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. I'm, of course, talking about Halloween the Deuce, Halloween 2. So, you've seen this before, right?
Yeah, I saw it recently, probably within the last 8 or 9 years.
I've seen it pretty recently, too, within the last 24 hours or so for the first time.
Oh, you saw it for the first time.
For the first time.
What did you think?
I really enjoyed it.
Me too.
I think it surprised me because I knew that it didn't have that... I think over time it doesn't have the best reputation.
Well, it's just a follow-up, you know? Like, how do you follow up a classic?
I think that's how you do it, really. It follows up an instant classic by just being an instant sequel instantaneously.
I love that about it. I love that it literally begins minutes after the first one ends.
Mm.
And it begins the same way as the first.
It's POV. Rocky style, baby. Yeah. they do the first 10 minutes is the last 10 minutes of the last one. It keeps on going.
I think it's really cool. I think I watched it a little bit cynically with, I was thinking, this is just the cash grab.
Yeah.
Donald Pleasance came back for the money.
Yeah. Jamie Lee Curtis is still there, but she's like in a coma for a lot of the movie.
John Carpenter didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
So it's going to be copying his style, using his score. But I really did enjoy it.
Mm.
Even though you're starting to see the beginnings of corny horror tropes. For example, the death by hot tub sequence in the hospital.
Oh, that's such a like putrid slasher moment.
Yeah.
It's like a full-on splatter film where you see someone's head get dunked into a hot tub.
Yeah.
And come up like a boiled chicken.
Yeah, like that already it's like, oh, okay, this sucks a little bit.
Yeah.
Like you can... interesting, intricate deaths suck.
And there's a full-on, like, sexy nurse.
Yeah, who's, like, got fake boobs and it's all...
like, red lingerie.
Yeah, this is, like, the beginnings of the 80s horror slashes, which were full of shit like that.
Yeah.
Like, obvious sex with, like, strippers being cast as characters and then like deaths by like fucking microwave and weird dumb shit.
Weird stuff. And I think what separates it from the horror slashes that would follow it is those slashes were very much more like Agatha Christie whodunits. They're like, there's a murderer in the house. Who could it be? And stuff like that. So this one being like this really urgent sequel where Donald Pleasance is like, he's still out there. He's got his gun out the entire movie, running around with his gun out. And they accidentally kill a teenager who's like dressed up the same as Mike Myers, where he's just like crossing the road and he's like, should we shoot him? Should we shoot him? And they're like, no, don't shoot him. Then a police car smashes this kid and it drives him directly into a van. He's pinned between the police car and a van. Then they both explode and they have to get like a dentist to come in and identify the body. He's like, well, he's only 17. He's like, Mike Myers is 21 years of age. He's like, he's still out there. And then they just forget about the kid. It's just like, it's pretty crazy. But yeah. I think the urgency and manicness of Donald Pleasance in the film just like kind of brings it up to that level.
Yeah, it's just not as classy as the first one, but it is still cool.
It's still cool. I think it's worth watching, but sadly no longer canon.
Yeah, that's
with
true.
With the new film coming out, true. It's no longer canon.
Yeah. Because this one introduced the idea that Laurie Strode is the brother or the stepsister of Michael Myers.
I think...
Or half-sister or some shit like that.
It's kind of complicated. I think she's the sister, but after she was like 3 years younger than him. And then before he even went on the rampage, the mother gave her up. It's like kind of complicated because she grew up with the Strodes. And there's a scene where like Mother Strode is just putting up like a blanket on the clothesline. She goes, I told you I'm not your mother.
Yeah, it's like, it's just stupid. Like that mythology of trying to tie them together is like, I find it a big stretch.
Yeah.
I don't care. I don't want people to be related in these things. It's just random. And that's what I liked about it.
Yeah. It gives that creepiness that it could happen to you.
But that hung
Nicolas Cage style.
That hung on to like all the sequels. Yeah. It was like Laurie is his brother.
Yeah.
Sister. Fucking hell. And then, you know, I think in this new one, they are completely undoing that.
Yeah.
So that's not a thing.
That's interesting. It's interesting that they're going back and going everything but one doesn't count.
Like, there's a scene in the first trailer for this new Halloween where someone says, isn't your mother the sister of Michael Myers? And another character says, no, that's just an urban legend. Like, I like that. I like that they've just acknowledged it, but also said it's stupid.
Yeah. Didn't Michael Myers disappear for a few years and we followed another family for a minute?
Yeah. Wasn't there something about a like haunted masks and leprechauns and shit like that? Oh, no.
No, that's an urban legend.
That's just an urban legend.
That's actually not related to this
at all. That's actually one of the dumbest ideas I've ever heard.
So, Cameron, next we'll be talking about Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which, of course, is what John Carpenter wanted to do if this was to be a franchise, where each one would be a separate, different type of movie. Have you ever seen Season of the Witch before?
Never.
Neither have I. I'm really interested to do it.
I want to do it purely because I think it's going to suck.
Mm.
But I'm also... I'm intrigued by this idea of an anthology series.
There's supporters for this film out there. There are out there in the world, especially on the internet.
It's just so funny that... We live in a world where they did try to make it an anthology.
Yeah.
And then just gave up and went back to the original plot and just... It's still part of it?
It's still part of it. You think it would just be called like Live, Die, Repeat style, like a different thing.
Yeah.
But they kept it part of the franchise. So that's the first kind of reboot or redirection of what this franchise was going to be.
Yeah. A new direction. Something I'm very excited about.
Yeah. You love that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, join us next week when we talk about Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. In the meantime, if you want to chat to us, you can head on over to twitter.com and type into the little search bar, Total Reboot Pods.
And you might get a nice surprise.
You might see us two there.
You can also talk to us individually. I'm at I Am Cameron James. Lex is at This Is Alexi.
And we're on Instagram at those two addresses as well.
Yep.
If you want to email us, you can email us at alexi@betapods.net. Just email me there. It's easier for me to find it that way.
What else can I say? Give us 5 stars on iTunes or all that kind of stuff. We love that. Join our Patreon if you want more bonus content. We've got a lot of fun stuff coming out over on the Patreon.
Yes. What we do on there, we do another podcast called Total Reboot Riffs, where we riff a classic film into a remake of our own design. We've done some really fun ones. Back to the Future is one that you've heard on this mainstream. If you want to head on over there, we've got some new ones, including one, our first TV to film reboot, Frasier, with a little rocky twist to it all.
What would that be like? Well, you'll have to subscribe to the Patreon to find out. Until then, thank you for listening to the only podcast on the internet about movies. We love you. And good night.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.